everybody. I'm Uncle Jim, your speaker captain and alcoholic. Hey, tonight I have the privilege of introducing Cecilia B., who has been sober and with us since September 14th of 2009. If you're passing through San Jose in a non-COVID year, you might stop by the Monday Night Women's Meeting, which is her home group. But currently she's living up there in the beautiful town of Oakland, near Oakland, California, called San Leandro. San Leandro. I'm very beautiful. I've been there. If we could give a warm Valley group welcome to Cecilia B. from San Leandro, that would be great.
Hi, I'm Cecilia, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you guys for inviting me to share tonight. So just a little bit about myself. I've actually been in the room since I was 13 years old. My first meeting, my probation officer took me to. And, of course, you know, everyone's smoking and old. I thought, you know, I was nowhere near ready to get it, but I was definitely an alcoholic. I took my first drink, my first planned drunk, I should say, when I was 10 years old. Earlier than that, I, you know, sipped my dad's beers, went and got beers from the fridge for him, took more sips. But at 10 years old, I was already, we stole a six-pack and it was going to be on. I've always loved the taste of alcohol, I mean, from an early age, but I've also always been a blackout drinker from the very first time. I love the way it made me feel. So I'm one of six girls in my family, and we're just learning my mom's background, but she had a closed adoption, and so we didn't really know her race. My dad's from Zacatecas, Mexico, and so I was really never white enough and never really Mexican enough. So I was that middle person that just didn't fit in. I always felt out of sorts. I always felt awkward. And in our house, you had to be loud if you wanted to be heard. My dad he whirled with an iron fist, and so, you know, what he said went, and everyone in the house was deathly afraid of him, and my mom was an amazing mom, but very, very subservient to my dad, and I look like my mom, but I'm actually a lot like my dad in temperament, and I decided really early on that if I had to choose who I wanted to be like, it would be my dad, because he got to do what he wanted, say what he wanted, go where he wanted, spend what he wanted, and so to me, I would rather be that asshole than the one that's begging for a few dollars to buy bread. I think of everybody that was in my household because I had the biggest mouth, and I just couldn't stand still for my dad, the way he spoke to us, and I stopped being afraid, and I got the brunt of a lot of the abuse from that. I was definitely his punching bag, and I just got hardened with that, but still somewhat sheltered in our home. My dad knew how to throw some awesome parties, and so I learned from him, you know, that you spend whatever you got to throw down on a party. And that was like my goal when I got older, that I would throw parties like my dad, you know, being around the campfire and everybody getting drunk. And I loved that because I got to run around and drink everyone's drinks. And that was when dad was friendly and giving us money because, you know, he had to show off in front of his friends and because he was drunk. But he was also spending our mortgage money and our grocery money. At any rate, that I really looked up to that. I continued to drink really throughout my entire life, but around 13 is when it really took a turn. I was pregnant, and I didn't know, like, what abortion was or miscarriage was. I didn't know any of that, but I just remember my cousin telling me, like, stupid, you're pregnant, and your dad's going to kill you. And I really believed that he would have because he was just that mean. Like, evil walked in when he walked in. And so we took turns hitting me, and I lost the baby. I had no idea. I just heard my mom, she rushed me to the hospital. I just heard her say she's having a miscarriage, and I chalked it up for my entire life. That's what it was. But there was a turning point for that because it didn't escape me. My drinking just got so bad. I put anything into my body just to change the way I felt. And I actually didn't figure that out until probably about 7 years ago, when I was in a study. But anyway, from there, I just drinking made me funny. I felt pretty. I belonged. I didn't care if I was with skinheads, if I was with cholos and lowriders, or if I was with the stoners at the beach. Whatever it was that they were putting into themselves, I fit in. If I had weed, if they had coke, if they had drinks, no matter where I was, it was universal, and I could turn into a chameleon and put on my CC smile and join that group and just develop this personality of whatever fit that. I was definitely a survivor. But I moved out of my parents' house when I was 14 years old, and my dad beat me pretty bad so that I would remember why I was leaving. But I hated it at home so bad that I would put myself into a lot of dangerous situations. I was a habitual runaway. I was in and out of juvenile hall for, 13 times, all over California in different group homes. And, I would rather be on the street experiencing that abuse that I was experiencing, the pain that I was experiencing, the hunger and the cold, all of that that you experience when you're living on the streets and panhandling for a burrito from Taco Bell. But the goal of every night was to get loaded. Of every day was to, no matter who it was with, we were going to get loaded. And I just continued to progressively get worse. Like I said, I've always known I was an alcoholic, and I wasn't ashamed of it. I was actually proud of it. Today I know the difference between an alcoholic and a drunk. I eventually became a drunk, not just a weekend partier. So fast forward, I aged out of the group home when I was 18, and my husband and I, we're celebrating 25 years this year together, and 30 years total. But we met when I was in the group home. And again, I changed, I morphed into that, whatever that environment was. But the drinking continued, and he's a total normie and a really good guy. But I cleaned up my life. I put on a suit and put on makeup and changed my clothes, and I got a job in finance. But I really didn't deal with any of that shit from before. So all it did is really slap, I just pretended again. I was very institutionalized, so I could put on whatever airs and just chop it up with the best of you. But when I drank and we went out, my true nature came out, and people were getting arrested. Girls from the bank were getting beat up and black eyes. And that's not normal shit, man. That's just not normal stuff. But to me, that was a normal life, to hit the bouncer and get thrown out of clubs. You know, didn't matter how much money I made, I was still that alcoholic and drug addict. Fast forward through that, I just drank alcoholically all the time, and I just hung out with people who drank just like me or worse. If you didn't drink like me, you couldn't keep up, then your friendship with me was really short-lived. But as I got working and making more money, and I really started to just put that life behind me, that little chola, that little chicana that was from the hood, I put that behind me, and I started just to really get addicted to power and money, and those things were consuming me. But in the meantime, I'm still drinking, still smoking weed. But then I met this guy at the bank, and he could use and go back to work on Monday. So my problem is more of everything, more of the gym, more of food, more of men, more of money, more of power, more of success. I have a problem with more, no matter what it is. And I remember the night that, and I know this is an AA meeting, so I'll keep that totally brief, but drugs are part of my story. And I remember when I took that bump at our Halloween party, like that moment I knew, like my life was about to change. And mind you, I was at the peak of my career, making the most money, we owned homes. That little toilet girl was way far behind me. But right as I put that shit in my body, man, I knew it was on. And I continued to use and drink to balance that out, and eventually I started calling in sick to work. And, I'm working from home, and I had allergies. I developed this allergy, right, overnight. And I could feel, like, stuff coming down on my face while I was sitting there talking with clients. But all of this happened right during the housing crisis and that financial stuff. And so our bank was bought out. And my boss came in, and thankfully I was there that day. He said, Sue, I hear a lot of great things about you, but to be honest with you, I've not seen them. And he gave me a card. He slipped it to me, and he said, don't tell me what's wrong. Just call this number. Please just don't tell me anything that's wrong. And so I called the number and I got checked into to a rehab for a 30-day program. And I thought for sure, like, I'm just going to get cleaned up and I'm going to go back to work. But when I got out, it was about 3 weeks. They just kept kind of making me linger. Not yet. We're not ready for you to come back yet. And finally, I just said, what's going on? And that's when my manager called me and he said, go ahead and bring your laptop and your keys. And I knew that I was being let go. But I had just learned in rehab about this program of honesty, right? And so I get called in, and all the things that they would have let slip before, because I made a lot of money for them, this was my day of reckoning, and they just had piles and piles of, like, this check not cash, this, forging a signature, and I felt defeated. I felt like I just needed to just fess up, no matter what the cost was. And so at that moment, I was permitted to resign, and I was walked out by my manager and by security. And I remember my boss patted me on the shoulder, and he said, I will sleep well tonight, even though you're being fired. Like, I will sleep well. And I thought, what an asshole, right? What I didn't know is that he was a believer. And what he had shared with me was this book. And he said, if you tell anyone I gave you the book, I'll deny it. And it was just during that time in the rehab, I reconnected my relationship with God. But being fired, I definitely wasn't ready. And I just went on a bender and just continued to drink for the next 2 years. I quit other stuff, but drinking just got worse, and it was just 24 hours a day. Literally, I couldn't be sober, not even for 30 minutes. Just always drunk driving, forgetting to drop my daughter off, forgetting to pick her up, doing that crazy alcoholic shit where you put something because you know you'll be able to find it there, like the keys, and then you end up looking all over the house, and then the principal brings her home. I remember picking mold off her bread. But damn it, I went to the store for that alcohol, right? But I didn't pick up any bread. And we did. We lost everything when I lost my job. But that was all necessary. And I know I could blame God, but it wasn't his doing. I think there was so many times before that I could feel God's nudge saying, cut it out, Cecilia, cut it out. Like, I'm going to save you this time, but cut it out. And I begged, just let me get out of this one time. And this time he didn't save me from myself. This time he allowed me to go through all of that. And little by little, we lost everything. But I didn't lose my husband, and I didn't lose my family, but I certainly lost my mind. And I was a raging alcoholic. All that shit before, all those arrests before, and all that time in juvenile hall was all for assault, all for robbery, I was angry, and I just wanted to fight the world. You just look at me crazy. I just look for it. I would walk through the mall and just want to hit somebody, so I'd elbow them so that they could talk shit so I could beat them up. And that was my mentality, total street, and it didn't change just because I got this career. Fast forward, though, I desperately wanted to get sober, but I couldn't until I let go of my past. And I did the steps. I worked with it was September 9th. It was September 9th of 2014. I had finally got another job with the bank. It was, September 14th. So on that Friday, I was supposed to fly out to New York to go train. And I remember I said, if I just get a job, I'll be better. I'll stop drinking if I get a job. And I remember they gave me all my new hire packet for the bank, and I was ready to go. I was going to fly out to the New York Stock Exchange and go work on the floor for 3 weeks for training. And I knew I had to get my itinerary, and so I was begging God to let them call by like 8:30 Eastern time, because I knew I wouldn't be sober if they called after 10. And they did call later, and sure enough, I slurred through the whole conversation. And the lady just said, I don't know what happened, Cecilia, but your offer's been withdrawn. And after that, I blacked out. I don't remember anything I said. All I remember is that my phone had like 5 or 6 calls with a lot of long minutes. So I don't know if I was leaving messages or talking to somebody, but at that point, it really didn't matter. I locked myself in the room and just drank myself for 24 hours. I don't even remember how many bottles it was. I would just wake up and I would find something left in the bottle, and it would be like the sigh of relief because I knew I would be shaking. And so I would scrammer around the house to fire or the room to find another, any little remnants of alcohol that was left. But that Sunday, I woke up and I put the bottle, I started to get the bottle and I put it to my mouth and I just couldn't take another drink. I'd woken up the week before on the floor of our bathroom, and on our bathroom wall, there's a mirror. And I remember just coming to AA, and mind you, I've been in and out of the rooms and in and out of rehab since I was 13. And that keep coming back, it works if you work it. I thought that was a cool shit. It bothered me to my core when you guys would do that, right? But on the bathroom floor, when I looked at myself and I had a busted lip, and I could feel the pain in my body from people either holding me down or restraining me, because like I said, I was violent, and I just knew something fucked up had happened the night before. But I looked up in the mirror, and I just kept hearing you guys say, keep coming back, keep coming back. And so it was on that Monday, September 14th, that I did cry out to God. And I did have that enlightening experience, that spiritual awakening for sure. I called out to God, and I was so ready to have a different life and to make some changes. Yeah, I said, I will take any job. I will scrub toilets. I will scrub floors. I don't care. Because before that, it was like, I'm supposed to get an hourly wage job. I was such a snob. It was ridiculous. But at that point, I was powerless, and I was ready to surrender. And I did, and I cried out to God. And the meetings that I had avoided, you know, with all, like, on the east side of San Jose, that was when I walked in on Monday night to the women's meeting. And I walked in to see all these cholas, all these old chicanas, all these OGs, you know, with their tattoos and their painted on eyebrows. And I knew I was home. I had run from myself for long enough. And it was time to finally just face myself. I got an amazing sponsor. Yeah, she's still my sponsor today. She's 89 years old. She had 40 years when I met her. And she's an old G. We're kindred spirits, but she is so kind and loving to me. And I really wanted her to be hard on me in this program. I was like, I need you to be hard on me. And she said, no, I think you do a good job of that all on your own. And but she just said, how about I just love you until you can trust and love yourself, until you can make the decision to get better. In the meantime, let's do the steps. And so I worked the steps with her. And let me tell you, I did the steps before, but I did them through other workbooks. And, like, I just complicated the shit out of it because I'm an alcoholic, right? But when we do it the way the book says, and we go through, especially with our fourth step, when we go through those columns this way instead of this way, how you see yourself is so amazing. That final column, when you have to repeat over and over your character defects, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm a taker, I'm unkind, I'm inconsiderate, and boy, am I afraid. Almost everything that I've done in my life was out of fear. Fear from losing, like the book says, fear from losing what we have, fear of not getting what is rightfully mine. All that fear to hold on to stuff, and the harder I tried to hold on to stuff, the faster I lost it. So I plugged into this program. I got into service. I was coffee girl and literature girl. I got fired from coffee girl because I wasn't ready yet. I would sneak in and make coffee and put the cookies out, and they knew I was drinking. But I thought I was fooling somebody, right? So I got fired from coffee girl, but I was literature girl, and damn it, don't you put that literature out, you know, before I get there. If you got there early, don't touch that shit. That's mine. And it was just so funny how, just on it, like, at the beginning of sobriety, how uncomfortable I was in my own skin. I had literally just turned, like, I was unsocialized. And so everything was, I was sensitive to everything. When they say you'll feel everything, they mean it. You'll feel everything, fear, anger, sadness, all those things, you're going to feel them. But as long as you tell on yourself, what they say, you're as sick as your secrets. And I do believe that. And so still to this day, I will tell another alcoholic, I will tell my family members, I'm thinking of relapsing. Even if I'm not in relapse mode, like, I totally want to drink, I totally want to hit, I totally want to do this, I tell on myself today because it takes the power out of it. And, but I got plugged in. I sponsor women now. I have sponsees all from New York and Texas and California, so it's kind of cool. Zoom has made that possible for sure. But I also carry the message. I'm not ashamed of my alcoholism. I know that I have a disease. I have an allergy to alcohol and an obsession of the mind. But it is contingent on my spiritual walk. I'm telling you, I can tell when I'm out of sorts, when I'm not been connected with my higher power, because that's when I get angry and I want to fight again. That old nature is still there. It just, it's waiting. So I have to stay in meetings. I have to continue doing my steps. I do my steps each time with my sponsees, and I get more out of it. So I love this program. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am excited because this year we're celebrating our 25th married wedding anniversary. I'm so grateful that my husband stayed, even though he had every reason not to. It was just by the grace of God that we made it. But forgiveness, I would say the topic tonight, if I can, is forgiveness. That has been by far the number one thing that has set me free. It's letting go of those things, identifying them, naming them, and forgiving them very specifically. And then when I needed to make those amends, doing them not out of order. I tried that. It doesn't work. I think it actually reset the button and started that amends all over again for about another 10 years. But I'm grateful to say that those relationships today are mended. Not all of them are reconciled, but there's healing and at least peace there. But forgiveness really is about letting yourself be free. And when you're free, inevitably, it really just works this way. Most of the time, I say, is that you attract those people, and there's something about you that's changed. And I used to tell my dad all the time, "But Dad, I've changed. I don't know why they don't forgive me." And he had this awesome saying. He'd say, "Mija, you don't have to tell everyone you're a lemon tree. They'll know when they see lemons." And he was right. I didn't have to tell people I changed. They just had to see me change. I didn't have to tell people I was different. They just had to see me be different. And for those who didn't believe it, the best I could do to offer was a living amends to not hurt them again. And so I'm so grateful for the program. I'm so thankful that you guys invited me tonight. And I'd like to turn it over to you guys. The topic tonight will be forgiveness. So do I just call on anybody, or?
Usually what we do at a point like this is invite people to ask you questions.
Right on.
So with the power of Zoom, people can use the raise hand button, or they can wave to get your attention. You can call on.
Full gallery here, so I can see people's hands. Okay, Leah, you want
to... Sorry, I was muted. Okay, so at this time, Cecilia will be taking questions. So if anybody has any questions for her... let's make that happen. I actually have a question. Leah's the alcoholic. So, in being sober within the first, like, year of being sober, you know, you got all those feelings of anxiety, stress, and all that. How did you cope with that during that time?
I stayed close to my sponsor. I remember this lady, she was new in the program, too. Because she'd tap a pin and shake her leg, and it bothered me to no end. It really bothered me, but I talked to my sponsor, and she'd just say, Grace, just give her grace, okay? She's in the same boat as you. So I would say just have a good connection and talk to people, talk to your sponsor as much as you need to. Bill.
Hi, Cecilia. Hey, so, you know, a lot of us come... I don't know if I want to say we come to our knees, right? Or we come to, the process of recovery. But we get to a point where we just can't do things the way we've been doing them anymore. And a lot of times when we get there, there are some things, some grudges that we've been holding on to that we... just can't imagine ever letting go of. And I'm curious if you've had any of those kinds of, we call them resentments here, but have you been so angry about what someone did or the way an institution, treated you or that you thought you could just never forgive for that offense? And what did you do about that? How did you step through that process?
So the great part about the steps is that, you know, as you do them over and over, it's not a one-time deal. It's not a checklist. You know, we don't ever graduate. More is revealed. And so sometimes we have those, like those heavy, like those ones that you can't stop thinking about. Those are the ones that are going to come up in your first course and you're going to write about them. But then, like, later, something's going to come up again, and you're going to be like, man, I thought I forgave my dad. And I did. This is just new shit that God has shown me. He's allowing me, like, I'm in the place where he's cleared out that wreckage, and now he's ready to show me more. Or there's just new offenses. So, but I will say that there was some resentment that I, for my uncle. He abused me and my sisters, a few of my sisters, and that was a great cause of pain in our family. And I apparently, when I was drinking in blackout stage, I would talk about it, but I wouldn't when I was sober, like, or clear-headed. I never brought it up. So I didn't even know that this thing was deep-seated in me. But working with my sponsor, I got to walk through that. And she did something awesome. She had me look at him like he was a child, close my eyes and kind of meditate with her. And we worked through that when we were doing the steps. And I did, and I asked God. I said, I'm ready. Like, I want to let this go, God. Like, I can't be sick anymore. Like, I'm being sick because I keep holding on to this. And he was dead, by the way. He died of swine flu. That's comical and ironic. but that releasing, and I just literally named the things that I needed to forgive him for and just did that process and walked through that. And let me tell you, today, I'm a believer in my higher power is Jesus Christ. And he was a believer before he gave his heart to the Lord, before he died. So I know we will meet again in heaven. And this is my faith, right? My higher power. And now I know when I see him that I can embrace him. I have literally let that go. And as more stuff comes up from that issue, I get to work through it and get to the root of why I feel those things. The other I would say was a lot of institutions, like not being Mexican enough, not being white enough, you know, like, because where we lived was an agriculture town and there was a lot of people from Mexico there. My dad didn't work in agriculture and I just felt like, I always felt like I had this judgment against us because we just didn't fit in anywhere really. And through all this like recent stuff, it brought up a lot of shit and it brought up some old feelings of how I felt when I was young, and I was enraged over this, and it was consuming me. And I knew, like, this is, like, I can't go down this path. I cannot afford a resentment, like, not like this. I couldn't sleep. It was consuming me. So I worked with my sponsor and talked to Fourth Step, and she had me write and see myself in that, what was my part. And I got to see, like, where that pain was coming from, and then, again, got to forgive and release them. Because it was the them, the institution or the race or the people, right? It was that I needed to work through. And through that, I got to see myself, and I got to really release that and forgive. Because it was more of the thing that I kept saying in my head over and over. The people from today, they weren't doing shit to me. I was doing this to myself. It literally was playing it over and over. And, of course, every time I replayed it, I made that story worse, right? You know, they got more evil and they treated me even worse. And so for that, I would say that those resentments, as they come up, you just work with them and just know that there will be more for – there can be more for one set of people or groups. You work through that, and then more is revealed or new pains. But you definitely don't want to hold on to them. I think of it as like when you're walking on a rocky gravel road, like you can hear the rocks under your feet. And that's when I know I'm like heading back to Egypt. Like I'm heading back to that place of bondage in my mind. So yeah, resentment, I can't afford them.
So Megan, alcoholic, I was wondering, my question's kind of on the other side of it, but did you have trouble, like, forgiving yourself through the process?
I think that was probably the hardest thing to do. Because really what I was trying to do is forgive myself instead of receiving God's forgiveness. Because he loves me fully. Like, he loves me fully. And when I had that understanding of higher power and the love that he has for me, that unconditional, that I kept beating myself up for that because I felt like I should suffer. I felt like I needed to suffer for me to really for me to really be able to show that I'm sorry. And I think I stayed lower, really, in my career longer than I needed to. Way longer than God asked me to, for sure, because I went into nonprofit work and I took my financial work into nonprofits to help them with their donors and stuff. But I kept myself low in positions and would not apply for different jobs because I was afraid. I was afraid that if I started making money again, that I was going to turn back into that person. And I was so deathly afraid of relapsing and going back. But still today, there's some things that creep up. That I have to let go. And I know I've forgiven myself, but there's times that I have to be able to allow myself to feel them. It's good for me to feel regret. We don't regret the past, or we should shut the door on it. But it's good for me to remember those consequences. It's good for me to remember that feeling. I don't have to live there, and I don't have to beat myself up constantly. But I do sometimes need that reminder to put me in check, to say, to remind myself how it was. But yeah, no, it took me a long time to be able to move past that, but I did. And it was a process for sure. Little by little, it got better. And today I am free from that. And now it's funny to say, you know, you're proud to be an alcoholic. I'm proud to be part of this fellowship, really. So I'm not ashamed of my past. And today I feel I am forgiven, and I have forgiven myself.
My name is Chris, I'm an alcoholic. Cecilia, I have a question because much like you had described with your alcoholism, it affected your job to where you were let go. I've had a couple of job abandonments due to DUI, so I was incarcerated and couldn't get my job back, obviously. It's very embarrassing. I have a lot of guilt, a lot of shame on that, especially it being a small town in this Tulare County. Being well known, and on top of that, always doing sales and retail. How did you get back out there and deal with the shame of maybe seeing some of your same clients or same customers? How did you deal with that? Because I'm on the resentment thing too, and guilt.
Oh yeah, no, gosh, you just took me back to those memories. Yeah, no, I remember because I was writing checks, I was, you know, paying, stealing a computer to pay Paul. And I went to, my ATM where I used to work at the bank, and, where these employees were like, they looked up to me. They really did. And here I was, my ATM got swallowed up by the machine, and there was a fraud alert. Yeah, nothing like, humble pie, right? So I went in, and she's like, okay, I don't know what's happening. But let me just tell you, there will come a time. For myself, I had to face it, and I actually went into the bank. I had to go into that place. I needed to face my past. And not everyone's able to do that, but I had to get right size about myself because I'm more than what my title was. I'm more than what my job was. Like, I have value outside of that today. Outside, I could be a janitor, and I know I have value. I could be at the highest CEO, and I know I have value. Like, none of that makes my value and my worth important. And really, I just say, check your posture. You're a daughter of the King. That's my higher power. You know, I'm a child of God, and I don't have to worry about that. But for the shame that you're talking about, I would say just kind of owning that, like writing out what you experience with that. Why do you feel that way? And because you're going to get mad at them. But then when you look and you turn that page around and totally putting out of mind what they've done to you, what did you do to get the ball rolling for them to gossip, for them to laugh at you, for them to talk about you? I mean, we set ourselves up, right? We give them the gun and the ammo, and then we wonder why they're shooting us. But when we can take ownership for that, and that's where your steps are going to come in. But that was a hard one for me, that shame of, I guess I finally had to detach myself from that job, that role, that success. I had to be okay with being who I was, no matter what circumstance or what job I had. And that was really what brought me some healing, a lot of healing, really. I'm trying to see if anyone else has their hand up. Feel free to just unmute and talk. Anyone from the groups out there? New Vision for Women. You guys want to chime in?
Okay. That was one of the ladies from New Visions that just asked that question.
Okay.
Hey, Cecilia, I'll ask you another question while we're waiting for others. I'm curious if you've had the tables of forgiveness turned around on you, where you've had someone come to you asking for forgiveness. Have you had that experience yet?
My husband. I'll be honest with you, because he is such a normie and literally just a really good guy. Like, better than I think I deserve sometimes. I didn't allow him to take responsibility for any of the stuff, the financial loss or any of those things. I owned it all, right? I made the money, I lost the money. It was my mess to keep. But my higher power saw that different. You know, we both needed to go through this to learn some lessons. And I think when we finally started doing some work together, some other, like, other Bible studies and stuff, like, he saw his part, and I allowed him to own that. So that was a real great healing. I would say that, you know, people have not asked me for forgiveness. I know my grandfather died. He was another person who abused. And he didn't have to in his lifetime. I had already forgiven him so much that literally, I was at peace with him. And he never had to say, he never had to admit, he never had to ask for forgiveness. That was not the requirement for me to be able to let that go. And not a whole bunch of people asked for forgiveness. That's okay, they're forgiven anyway.
So, Cecilia, the alcoholic, did you have, when getting sober, did you have any, really close friends, like, say, best friends or anything like that, that were in that life that you had to, eventually cut ties with, and how did you deal with the emotions with all of that?
So, part of my, surrendering was that every door closed. Like, my money wasn't good enough anymore. I was not going to be invited anywhere. But, you know, that was what was necessary when my sister said, don't come anymore. So they don't call anymore until you get sober. When all those doors started closing, and that meant it no longer worked. It wasn't going to keep working because they weren't going to keep inviting me to family functions. I was locked out. So by the time I got sober, I really didn't. I was a solo drinker. I drink all by myself in my house in my room. But I did, I even still going back though, I had to cut ties with all of those things. Even for the first few years of my sobriety, even listening to oldies and reggae and all that stuff, because it would stir some shit up. Like, I was like, hey, I want a beer. And, and so those emotions would stir up. And so for a long time, I couldn't listen to that or very, tempered, I guess you could say. Today I can listen to everything and I'm cool. But I know sometimes I put on some M&M and I get triggered. So I have to be careful. But I don't go to this. You do. You have to change your playmates, your playgrounds, and your toys, for sure. Until you're ready or until you're safe enough to be able to go around people. But if they're drinking alcoholically, you don't even need to be around them. I know the people who are invited to my wedding anniversary, none of them are going to be wilding out. None of those drunk old people are invited. Because today I have choices. Today I don't have to put myself in these situations where people come and fuck up my event. I have choices today. Not you. And I can love them from a distance. I think we got 2 minutes before we have to wrap up. Let's see the chat. Any burning desires out there?
Yeah, Amy, I'm Jim, alcoholic. Hey, you got any family who just irritate the crud out of you that you just don't want to be around? And what do you do about that?
I don't be around them. That's another choice. So I make a plan. I make an exit strategy, especially in my early sobriety. I can go anywhere unprepared. I went to a meeting, I went prayed up, I talked to my sponsor, and I had an exit strategy. I always drove myself to functions I never got right, because I knew because we're sick. My family's sick, and we're all, just trying to make it through life. And so I can't leave it up to them to treat me right. but I can treat you right. I can put some boundaries. And so for me, when it starts to get, you know, people start winding out, I can leave. When the music, when the lights go down and the food goes away, it's time for me to go. But I can also go pre-forgiving. So if I know someone, like, you know you're going to see them and you know they're going to say the same things over and over, you kind of pre-forgive. I go in there saying, God, you know, I just forgive them for, and then when they do whatever it is I think they're going to do, I go, oh, there it is. But I don't have to own their stuff. That's on them. I don't react. And I stay away from them. The one thing I did learn is I wanted to make it right with everybody. And I did try to force some relationships that just were never going to happen again. And so today we can be cordial. I don't have to kiss their ass and they don't have to avoid me. We can just be cordial and respectful. But that I know that I'm free from that. And that's their shit, not mine. Sorry, I know I kiss a lot. All right, I think that's it. We're out of time.